Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Excuse me, Jimmy Akin. I choked up on my own name a little bit. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's an internet ask me anything. Lots and lots of questions from the internet for Jimmy. I'm glad we have lots and lots of questions because you went through a book of them the first hour. You were just cranking through questions the first hour.
I went through 15. I think my record is like 20 questions in 1 hour. Back in the early days of Catholic Answers.
Wow.
But it was like, I think it was like kids' questions, because kids don't waste time getting to their question.
No. Kids are magical that way. The context, yeah, Not so important to them.
They know what they want to know, and yep, they ask it directly without a lot of secret backstory.
And you know what? People on the internet do that. It's harder to type than it is to talk. Mm-hmm. So this one comes from Byzantine Deacon. Did fetal
microchimerism
have a part to play in Mary's assumption?
Okay, so fetal microchimerism, for folks who may not be aware, involves the cells of a fetus remaining in the mother after birth. So, you know, there's an exchange of blood and things like that happens, and it doesn't all go one way. It's not just that nutrients from the mother go to the baby. The mother also receives some cells from the child that she's carrying, and those cells can remain in her body after birth. And so that's what fetal microchimerism is. A chimera is, it's a monster from Greek mythology that involves a fusion of other creatures. So like it might have, like a griffin is a chimera. It's got like an eagle's head and a lion's body and stuff like that. It's a fusion of different creatures. And so chimerism is where you have a single individual. This is the non-mythological kind. In science, chimerism is where you have a mixture of cells from different creatures, and it can be 50-50. You know, you can have like if you have twins and one twin absorbs the other, the resultant entity is going to have, well, half of its cells are going to come from one twin and half of its cells are going to come from the other twin. And there are people like this who are walking around that have no idea they're a chimera of two different original twins. And it's called microchimerism because it happens on the cellular level. Fetal microchimerism is where the mother acquires cells from the fetus or child that she was carrying. So that's what fetal microchimerism is. Did it have anything to do with Mary's assumption? Well, it seems very unlikely to me that it would have played any causal role in Mary's assumption. Because if all of the cells, I mean, think about how would this work? If all of the cells that had ever been part of Jesus ascended when he ascended, then those cells presumably would have left Mary's body at that time. I mean, it's not like they would serve as tiny little hooks or anchors that would yank her body up into heaven. They wouldn't naturally have enough heft to do that, because the number of cells that a mother acquires through fetal microchimerism is very, very, very small, and they wouldn't support the weight of her body. It's more likely that they would just exit her body and go up to heaven themselves. But I don't think that's what's happened either, because Jesus shed body cells his entire life, like we all do, you know, losing skin cells and hair cells and fingernails and all kinds of things. And I don't think all those ascended. I think Jesus took the body that he had at the end of his life with him to heaven. I don't think God yanked up everything that had ever been part of his body. But one way or another, we know Mary did not ascend when Jesus did, because she's still there in the book of Acts after the ascension of Jesus. We read about her being with the disciples in the early church in Acts 1:14. Now, you'll often hear her portrayed as being there on Pentecost, but the Bible does not say that. That Pentecost chapter 2, Mary is mentioned in chapter 1. So it doesn't say that she was there on the day of Pentecost. She may have been, but it doesn't say that. There's also another reason why I'm skeptical that microchimerism would have played a causal role in her assumption, which is nobody knew about it in the first century. We didn't even know about it until the late 20th century, you know, because it's only been that recently that we could do genetic testing on cells and discover, oh, some of the fetus's cells remain in the mother's system. So it's not like this would have been a sign that was perceivable to anybody back in the first century. Now, that's not to say that fetal microchimerism couldn't play some kind of role here in a way known to God, but I don't think it played a causal role, because if it had played a causal role, Mary should have been assumed at the same time Jesus ascended, and we know that didn't happen.
All right. Thank you very much for the question. I hope that that answer was helpful to you. That was Byzantine Deacon. This question, yeah, I got time for another one before the break. This one comes from Theo. There is a practice where people fast during Lent from one thing, a food or a vice. Some people say that when you pray Sunday evening prayer one on Saturday, it's now Sunday, where you feast and you don't have to fast from your Lenten fast anymore. Is this a sound practice, or should one only stop their Lenten fast on Sunday?
Okay, so technically the liturgical day in the Latin Rite starts at midnight. And so, you know, Sunday doesn't start until midnight Saturday night. But that doesn't stop anticipatory things, like, for example, masses on Saturday evening that fulfill the Sunday obligation. Even though it's still really Saturday, it's not really Sunday. It's still really Saturday. It's just this fulfills your Sunday obligation. Beyond the required fasting and abstinence, which apply to Ash Wednesday, Good Friday, and the Fridays of Lent, giving up something for Lent is purely voluntary. And you'll notice none of those required fasts and abstinences happen on Saturday. It's traditional in some places for people to like also abstain from meat on Saturday or things like that, but that's optional. And in the same way, if you choose to fast from some food or abstain from some food or from some vice or whatever for Lent, that's all purely voluntary. And so therefore, if you want to stop giving up something on Sundays in Lent, you're welcome to do that because it was voluntary in the first place. And in the same way, if you want to stop abstaining from that thing after evening prayer on Saturday or after the anticipatory mass on Saturday, you're free to do so because it's all voluntary to begin with. And if that's how you want to have a kind of expanded celebration of the Lord's Day, even though technically it's still Saturday, you're welcome to do that.
Theo, thanks. I hope that was helpful to you. Jimmy Akin's our guest. It's an Ask Me Anything today. All the questions are in. It's an internet version of Ask Me Anything. We'll continue with questions right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Catholic Influencers is a great podcast from Australia. It studies the weekly readings and breaks them down into layman's terms, showing you how they're relevant to our life today, making theology accessible for everyone. You can hear Catholic Influencers as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world, all in one place, all free at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click Podcast Central today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest, and it's an Ask Me Anything, an internet Ask Me Anything, so I get to read the questions and pronounce the names. And this one comes from Kaiser4506. Kaiser4506 asks this, Jimmy, is it true that the ends never justify the means? It seems that this belief would prohibit things like war. A popular moral question is, if the Nazis ask you where a Jewish family is hiding, isn't it best to lie? How else can you respond? I haven't heard you speak on this, and I'm interested in your perspective.
Okay, so I've actually addressed the lying question a bunch, but I'm happy to do it again. When people say that the ends don't justify the means, what they mean by that is that a good end will not justify a means of getting to that good end. That is intrinsically evil. So good ends don't justify intrinsically evil means. For example, you can't murder an innocent person in order to achieve some good goal. Murdering an innocent person is intrinsically evil, and so it can never be done, even if you're doing it for some good purpose, like you're going to save the world or something. You can't murder an innocent person. But using lethal force to stop an aggressor is not intrinsically evil. In fact, it can even be praiseworthy. And that's why a defensive war, either in defense of yourself or in defense of someone else, some vulnerable nation, is morally legitimate. So it's not like stopping an aggressor, you know, even by lethal means, is not the same as killing an innocent person. And so that's the difference in those scenarios. Using lethal force to stop an aggressor is not intrinsically evil. It may be evil if there's a better way to do it that doesn't involve lethal force, but it's not intrinsically evil, and therefore it can be justified by a sufficiently good end, like, you know, ending the war and defending innocent human life. It's only intrinsically evil means that can never be justified. It has to be intrinsically evil. When it comes to lying, what to do when the Nazis ask you where the Jewish family is going to depend on your theory of lying. There are people in Catholic tradition who believe that the use of deception is intrinsically evil. And for those people, you would not be able to lie to the Nazis. You just couldn't do it. You might be able to stay silent, or you might be able to use a non-deceptive mental reservation, like, look over there, squirrels, and, you know,
and hope for the best.
Get out of it and hope for the best. But you wouldn't be able, on this theory, to use deception to save the Jewish family. On the other hand, if you believe that deception is not intrinsically wrong, and I happen to be of that opinion, and I've talked about it elsewhere, then you could use deception to save innocent life from the Nazis. And so I could lie to the Nazis and tell them the Jewish family is somewhere that they're not, in order to throw the Nazis off the correct path.
Kaiser, thank you. Appreciate the question. On we go to Janker, 1676. Why do priests not get to marry? Doesn't this lead some into sexual sin anyways when they harm children in the worst cases? God gave us a holy marriage between men and women for this purpose. Why?
Okay, so some priests actually are married. In various Eastern rites of the Catholic Church, there are a lot of married priests, and there's even a few in the Latin rite. They tend to be priests who've converted from another Christian faith, like, let's say they were Anglican priests before they became members of the Latin rite, and so they were already married, and then they got ordained as a Catholic priest. So it does happen. But most priests in the Roman rite or the Latin rite of the Church don't marry. And this is a prudential decision rather than one that's required by doctrine. And because it's only a prudential decision, it could be revised in the future if the church determines that it would be better to allow married priests. However, we shouldn't cross-connect it with sexual abuse of children, because letting someone get married really doesn't have much to do with that. I can't say there are no cases where it would prevent child sexual abuse, but really, men who are attracted to children, whether it's children below the age of puberty, which is known as pedophilia, or children above the age of puberty, which is known as ephebophilia, they are not the kind of men who are attracted to ordinary women and want to get married. That's a separate disorder. And so the guys who would get married are not likely to be the guys who are attracted to children. And so letting guys get married to adult women in the priesthood would not have a substantial impact. I can't say no impact, but it wouldn't have a substantial impact on childhood, on child sexual abuse. That has to be dealt with through other means. And fortunately, the church has been adopting other means for dealing with that. Also, this needs to be kept in perspective of the fact that the places where the most childhood sexual abuse happens is in families and in schools and not the priesthood. The priesthood got a bad reputation for this for various reasons having to do with our legal system and how the Catholic Church keeps records and makes it easy to uncover these cases and sue people. But sociologically, statistically, most of the child sexual abuse is happening in families and schools. In any event, you could argue that if more priests, could marry, that there would you could argue, for example, that if more priests would marry, there would be less sexual seduction of women, adult women. You know, priests wouldn't be having affairs with women if they could marry. And that's true. There would be less of that. It's not like there would be none, because even married men have affairs with other married women. So just because a priest has a wife doesn't mean it's going to completely stop. But it would, you could argue it would be better. The basic reason, though, that priests are not married, for the most part, in the Latin Rite is a prudential decision that's based on a few factors. One of the factors is that priestly by being celibate, which just means unmarried, by being celibate, priests are conformed to the state of life that our Lord Jesus himself lived. Jesus was not married. And so priests conform themselves to the way Jesus lived. They also thereby conform themselves to what we will all ultimately be, because Jesus tells us that in the resurrection, people are not going to marry or be given in marriage. We're all going to be celibate in the end. And so priests are living out that final reality now by being celibate now. And it thus serves as a form of consecration. They consecrate themselves to God's service by imitating Jesus and imitating the final form of all of mankind. And there's also a side benefit, which is it frees them up for ministry. You know, St. Paul, who was himself celibate, recommends celibacy. He notes that, you know, he and Barnabas were celibate. He also encourages Timothy to remain celibate. And he recommends celibacy in general, saying if someone is a woman and they're unmarried, then they can serve the Lord Jesus single-heartedly. Or if someone's a man and they're unmarried, they can serve the Lord Jesus single-heartedly. But if you get married, it's gonna create some drag on that situation, because you can't just serve Jesus single-heartedly. You also got to be concerned about pleasing your spouse, whether it's a wife or a husband. And so the New Testament actually recommends celibacy for those who can accept it, as did Jesus himself. Jesus himself, when asked about celibacy, said, well, it's not for everybody, but let those who can accept it. And so the church has looked at that and said, okay, at least in the present state of history, it looks advisable for most priests in the Latin Rite to be celibate. And so that's the practice that's been adopted, but it's not a doctrine and it could change.
Thank you so much for the question. That was Janker 1676. Thank you, Janker, for the question. Lots more questions, and so on we go. It's an internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin today. Josh N91 asks this, Jimmy: if the West believes in original sin and the Eastern Orthodox believe in ancestral sin, where does that put Eastern Catholics? I spoke with one Eastern Catholic priest who said they affirm ancestral sin, but I thought in order to be Catholic, you had to believe in original sin.
Okay, so I think it's going to come down to the definitions that one uses for the terms original sin and ancestral sin. What is called original sin in the West is commonly called ancestral sin in the East. So it's just two different ways of referring to the same thing. For example, if you look at the Latin version of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the phrase that it uses for original sin in Latin is peccatum originale, which just means original sin. But if you look at the Greek translation of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the phrase that it uses in the same passage is propatarike hamartia, which means ancestral sin. And so the different editions of the Catechism treat original sin and ancestral sin as meaning the same thing. So I think one should understand the two terms as being equivalent to each other, unless in a particular case someone defines one in a way that excludes the other. So the starting point for the discussion is assume they mean the same thing. But if you stumble across someone who understands one of the terms in a way that excludes the other term, then there's more to talk about, but only in that situation.
All righty. Thank you very much, Josh, for that question. This one comes from Nyrick Dare Og 397. Nyrick, thanks so much for the question. Both are good. But is it better to know history or philosophy concerning Catholicism or life in general? Your opinion.
Well, you're asking a philosopher by training, but I also know a lot of history. I read history, so I'll try to give you an unbiased answer. You really want to learn something of both. But if you have to choose to focus on one rather than the other, it's going to depend on your situation. Philosophy deals with fundamental principles that undergird many topics. For example, logic. You know, logic is a branch of philosophy, and logic is used in all kinds of different disciplines. But also, you know, things like epistemology, which is how we learn things, morality, what we should do. On the other hand, history deals with what people have actually done in the past, and there's a value to knowing, well, so what's the track record been? What have people done and how did it work out? So which you need more, if you have to make a choice, is going to depend on which types of questions you interact with more. Is it the more fundamental type of questions that philosophy deals with, or is it more track record-based questions of what's happened in the past? For practical purposes, theologians and apologists need to know something of both history and philosophy. You can't do a good job as a theologian if you don't know both philosophy and history, particularly the history of theology. And as an apologist, you can't do a good job as an apologist if you don't have philosophical background and if you don't have historical background, because people are going to bring up historical questions like, why did this happen in the Catholic Church in the past? And so you need to know some of both. But if you have to choose, it's going to depend on which sets of questions you personally interact with more.
Nyrick, thanks for the question. We're back to the exciting names. Das Rufzeichen, 6389. I wonder how many Das Rufzeichens there are.
Nice job on pronouncing that rough aspiration on the Zeichen.
Thank you. I'm very proud of my rough aspirations. I have a question concerning canon 285.2 of the 1983 Code of Canon Law. It states, clerics are to avoid those things which, although not unbecoming, are nevertheless foreign to the clerical state. Is the law thinking of any special area here? Could you give an example of something that is totally fine to do for a layperson, but not for a priest?
Yeah, so it's helpful to know something about the legislative history, and I'll have to finish this answer on the other side of the break, but it's helpful to know something of the legislative history of this canon, because originally in the 1917 code, it did list some specific things that it said priests should not do, even though they're not wrong in and of themselves, but it didn't want priests doing them. Examples of that are medicine and surgery, and presumably it didn't want priests doing those, because if a priest is performing surgery or treating a person and they don't get better and they even die, people could blame the church. And so they wanted, even though medicine and surgery are fine, they didn't want priests doing it. And this actually plays in to an interesting situation back in the 1940s. There was a question of, could priests be dowsers? Could they could they douse? You know, could they find water or find gold or oil or missing persons by using the discipline known as dowsing? And the Vatican was more open to this than you might think. I mean, Pius the 11th gave his blessing to a French society of dowsers. He read about dowsing. They used a dowser at the archaeological excavation, a priest who was a dowser at the archaeological excavations under the Vatican. And in 1942, the Holy Office gave a ruling on whether priests could do dowsing. Now, it didn't rule about lay people. So there are no restrictions on what lay people can do. But what it said was priests can douse as part of scientific experiments on dowsing, but we don't want them doing other stuff, like, for example, medical consultations.
Oh.
And so even priests can do dowsing as part of scientific experiments, and there's no restrictions on laity. But there's more to say about this issue, and I'll say it on the other side of the break.
Right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ, September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast, visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, marching through the questions with Jimmy Akin. We have been on a march today through questions and lots more questions to come. Jimmy gave us a ton of questions. I think you foresaw this possibility that we were just going to be working through them quickly today.
Oh, yeah. Every time we do a pre-record, I have 30 questions ready. And that's usually enough. We haven't hit 30, but I even have some more beyond that on for emergencies.
All right. Well,
but getting back to answering this question.
Oh, I forgot, Jimmy. I apologize.
No problem. So the 1917 code listed like medicine and surgery as things that are not wrong, but they didn't want priests doing them. But they took those out in the new 1983 code. And presumably the reason for that is to allow for variation in local sensibilities, because different cultures look on different tasks differently. You know, what would be considered appropriate for a priest in one culture could be considered inappropriate for a priest in another culture. So rather than mandate a certain specific list of tasks, they left that up to the local bishops or bishops' conferences to figure out. But there is at least one commentary on the 83 code that suggests priests should not be doing psychoanalysis.
Okay.
Because there's nothing wrong with psychoanalysis, but it's an intimate relationship and it may not go well because psychoanalysis doesn't have a huge success rate and you don't want people blaming the church for your mental problems. So that's one factor. Also, there's an equivalent canon in the Code of Canons for the Eastern Churches. So this is not Latin Rite, but one of the things it says is that a priest needs to obtain permission from his hierarch if he's going to practice any civil profession. So they don't want priests doing any civil profession in the Eastern Rites unless you get special permission. There are also other sections in this canon after section 2 that name some things that priests should not do, and there's nothing wrong with them in and of themselves, but it does go on to prohibit certain things. These include the assumption of public offices that involve the exercise of civil power. So they don't want priests having civil power like being a lawmaker or a judge or something like that over laity, and certain types of financial involvement. They want to keep priests and the money separate so that you don't have like a priest as an investment advisor telling you how to make money or not.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Well, that was an interesting question, Das Ruff. Thanks very much for that. This next one comes from Shepherd Dog 1199. Do you like tooled leather?
Well, I wear a tooled leather belt and tooled leather boots. Tooled leather is just leather that's had someone's used tools to put designs on it. And I have a tooled leather belt and tooled leather boots, so I guess I prefer that to undecorated leather in those circumstances. On the other hand, I have an untooled leather pipe holster on my belt, and so I prefer it not to be decorated with a bunch of designs, so I guess I don't always prefer tooled leather. And in case you're wondering what a pipe holster is, it's one of these. It's got a hole on the back, you put your belt through it, it's got an opening on the front, you stick your pipe down in it, and you can carry your pipe on your hip.
All right, kind of a shepherd dog, kind of a mix there on the tooled leather, but we haven't gotten that question before, so you've got that in your favor, shepherd dog. This one comes from H Dog. Dog spelt differently this time, but H Dog 65. Can you explain vicarious satisfaction? Really? A guy named H Dog says, can you explain vicarious satisfaction as taught by Aquinas versus penal substitutionary atonement? And is penal substitution the foundation for salvation by faith alone?
Okay, so there are different variations on vicarious satisfaction, and I'll try to give you a short summary of Aquinas's version of it. It is different, for example, than Anselm's version. But basically, Aquinas understood Christ as making satisfaction with God on our behalf. Satisfaction is doing enough or given enough. And so he did it on our behalf, so that's the vicarious part of vicarious satisfaction. And then by his death, he makes satisfaction or gives God enough to compensate God for, in fact, in Aquinas' view, to more than compensate God for our sins. So that's a basic, super basic look, actually a little oversimplified, but that's the core of Aquinas' understanding of vicarious satisfaction. It's satisfaction because something happens to give God more than enough to compensate for our sins, and it's vicarious because Christ does it on our behalf. He's our vicar, our substitute. Okay, so what's penal substitution? Well, penal substitution agrees with vicarious satisfaction, but it goes a step further, and that's the penal part. Pena means punishment, and so what penal substitution says is that God literally punished Jesus in our place, or as preachers of this doctrine sometimes say, he poured out his wrath on him. Well, the Bible never says he poured out his wrath on him. That's a preaching trope. It's not something the Bible says. And there is virtually no basis for penal substitution anywhere in the Bible. There is one passage in Isaiah 53 that has language that could be used to support penal substitution, but Isaiah is prophecy and prophecy is poetry. And so it's not a guarantee that this language is being used literally. And so the idea that God would literally punish one person in place of another person is very problematic because it's manifestly unjust to do that. You know, one person can satisfy for another person. Like if your son has a speeding ticket and he can't pay it, well, you could pay it for him. You could make satisfaction to the court on his behalf. That's not unjust. But let's say your son killed somebody. You couldn't say, send me to the electric chair instead if you're an innocent person. That would be unjust to punish an innocent person instead of the guilty. So it's very problematic. And although there may be some people in the Protestant community who might claim that penal substitution is needed as a basis for the doctrine of faith alone, many other people would disagree. The fact is that the use of the faith alone formula is independent from any particular theory of the atonement that one has. Some Catholics, including Aquinas, used the faith alone formula, at least on occasion. And as Pope Benedict XVI said, it's perfectly acceptable as long as you understand the kind of faith in question to be faith formed by charity, which actually even John Calvin agreed with. He said if it doesn't include charity or love, it's not true faith. So if you understand the faith correctly, faith alone is an okay formula. And it's accepted by Catholics who don't use penal substitution. And it's also accepted by many Protestants who use the faith alone formula much more regularly than Catholics do. But many Protestants don't accept penal substitution. And so I can imagine there could be people who would say, oh, yeah, you need penal substitution as a basis for faith alone. But the truth is they're really independent. You got people who use faith alone who don't use penal substitution.
H-Dog, thank you. Appreciate the question. I hope that answer was helpful to you. SVE155 is next. SVE asks, kind of a silly question. But when Moses, Elijah, and other Old Testament characters saw God, in quotes, did they see Jesus before he was sent from heaven and born unto the world through the Blessed Virgin Mary? Or did they actually see God the Father?
Okay, so Sykelet, you know how I've mentioned that there will be occasions where I'm studying some obscure question that's not in the news, and then within 48 hours I'll be asked about it professionally?
Is this one of those?
This is one of those. I was studying completely randomly. I was not looking for this, but I was studying this mere hours before I processed this question. Now, I knew the basic answer anyway, but you know, having just read about it enables me to give a more definite answer. The basic answer is the church does not have a teaching on this. It doesn't teach what were the theophanies, that's an appearance of God. What were the theophanies in the Old Testament? They are appearances of God, but is it the Father, the Son, or the Holy Spirit? Church has no teaching on that. But most, the overwhelming majority of the church fathers, of the early church fathers, held that the theophanies of the Old Testament were Christophanies. They were appearances of the pre-incarnate Christ. But St. Augustine disagreed with this, and he popularized the contrary view, that they're not specifically Christophanies. So there's a mix of opinion that's been there down through history. You have the one stream, which predates Augustine, that says, yep, that's the pre-incarnate Christ. And then you have another stream that begins with St. Augustine that says, actually, it's not the pre-incarnate Christ specifically.
All right. Well, there you go, SVE. Thanks very much for the question. That'll bring us to the break. We'll be right back with more questions from the internet for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. and the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1999. The shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament of Our Lady of the Angels Monastery in Hansville, Alabama is consecrated. Mother Angelica says, "The happiest day of my life was the day this church was dedicated."
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for being here with us. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and it's an Ask Me Anything. But all the questions are already in. They have come to us via the internet. Sometimes we do that. And this one comes from Axe Apologist 1991. Axe Apologist asks this. You, Jimmy, have previously critiqued the philosophical version of the Kalam argument because you believe God is capable of actualizing a universe with an infinite past.
Yep.
Let's take that for granted. It seems to me that an atheist cannot make such an appeal to support the possibility of an infinite old universe. Therefore, could someone use the philosophical version of the Kalam argument as sort of a sort of internal critique of the atheist worldview? One could say what you describe is impossible without divine omnipotence making it happen.
Okay, so for folks who may not be aware, I should mention what the Kalam cosmological argument is. It can be put different ways, but one of the basic common ways is everything that has a beginning has a cause. The universe has a beginning, therefore the universe has a cause, and that cause we call God. I've written a whole bunch about the Kalam argument, and if you want to read what I've written, you can go to jimmyakin.com/Kalam. That requires you to do the daunting task of spelling my name correctly, Jimmy, AKIN.com/Kalam, in this case spelled KALAM. So you can go there, got a whole bunch of articles about it. In regard to Axe Apologist's question, so what I and the atheist would agree on is that an infinite history is possible. I agree to that because I think God could make it happen. The atheist also could agree that an infinite history for the universe could happen. At least many atheists would. They would say there is no God and the universe has just always been there. So the thing we agree on is that an infinite history is possible. Now, I don't think an infinite history actually exists because the Bible teaches that God made the universe with a finite history. But I think by his omnipotence, God could have made it another way. So the atheist and I agree an infinite history is possible. The question then is whether you need a God to explain it if an infinite history existed. It's not, the infinite history itself doesn't show that a God exists unless you use some other argument, like the contingency argument, like why does anything exist at all? You know, if anything exists at all, it needs a cause. And so this infinite history needs a cause, and that cause would be God. Okay, yeah, but that's a different argument than the Kalam argument. That's the contingency cosmological argument. It's not the Kalam cosmological argument. And so the mere existence of an infinite history would not show God's existence without an additional argument that is different from the Kalam. And so I'm all fine with saying let's grant an infinite history for purposes of the discussion, and let's go on to prove the existence of God some other way. But notice that you're shifting from the Kalam argument to a different argument, because the atheist is just his starting position is going to be, well, the universe has just always been there with no cause. So you've got to do something more to show him there needs to be a cause, and that's a different argument than the Kalam argument. Incidentally, Trent Horn explored an idea that was kind of like this at a discussion that he and I had at last year's conference. And if you go to my YouTube channel, youtube.com, and type in Kalam. You'll find that discussion, and you can watch what he and I had to say about it.
Thank you, Axe. Appreciate the question. Let's see. We can get to Paul71H, who wants to know this. To what extent is the Catholic dogma of the Assumption of Mary a potential stumbling block to reunion with Eastern Orthodox churches? I have heard that they believe something similar called the Dormition of Mary, but I don't know if the belief is uniform among all Eastern Orthodox churches or if it's exactly the same as the Assumption.
Okay, so the Dormition of Mary is a little bit different. Dormir means to sleep. And so the Dormition of Mary is the fallen asleep of Mary, which is a metaphor for the death of Mary. And so in Eastern Orthodoxy, it's common to have a commemoration of the death of Mary, referred to her as her Dormition. And that's not the same as her Assumption. But the two are compatible because the standard view, both in Catholicism and in Orthodoxy, is that after Mary died, she was then assumed body and soul into heaven. Maybe she got resurrected first or in the process of being assumed, but she was assumed body and soul into heaven. And you even see some really interesting icons of this, Eastern Orthodox icons, where they'll have Mary as a woman holding the baby Jesus, who's all wrapped up in swaddling clothes. And then they'll have Jesus holding Mary wrapped up in swaddling clothes, representing her ascension and representing her Dormition and Assumption into heaven. So, because they would wrap people up when they buried them. And so you have this juxtaposition of Mary taking care of Jesus as a baby and Jesus taking care of Mary at the end of her life. It is commonly believed that Mary was assumed in Eastern Orthodoxy, but it's not an infallible dogma for them. And, well, okay, so how would we handle this ecumenically? Well, Catholics, because it is infallibly defined for us, we can't de-elevate that. We can't return that to the state of ordinary teaching. So what would need to happen, which is what it is for most Orthodox, so what would need to happen is there would be a discussion between the Catholic Church and Eastern Orthodox churches, if we're at the point of reconciliation, of do they need to believe the same thing about this as Catholics do? And the answer could go either way. It could be, well, yeah, since the Catholic Church has now infallibly defined this, you need to accept it too as an infallible dogma. And they, if we're really at the point of reconciliation, that may not be a problem for them anymore. They may be prepared to recognize that. On the other hand, the decision could go the other way and say, you know, when we were in union in the past, this wasn't a dividing issue between us. You know, it wasn't an infallible dogma for Catholics then. And we could still, people who did believe it as definite versus people who didn't, we were still part of the same church then. And so we don't need to be divided by it now. So there'd have to be a discussion of this, but those are some of the different ways that that discussion could go.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate the question. On we go. Let's go to Dennis G33. Why did God not give us a mortal sin or grace detector so we can know with certitude what we did was deadly or venial or simply a vice?
Well, let's start by recognizing what he did give us. He did give us a conscience. He wrote his law in our hearts, as St. Paul says. And so he did give us a guide to this subject. It's unfortunately not infallible because of what are called the noetic effects of sin. That's the effects of sin on our minds, particularly original sin, that makes our sense of conscience unreliable in some respects. But then he also gave us divine revelation so that when our consciences fail us, we can look to divine revelation. Unfortunately, divine revelation is limited. It doesn't answer every question. And so he also gave us a magisterium, which can look at revelation and conscience and the natural light of reason and speak infallibly to moral subjects. So he did give us a mechanism by which we could hypothetically arrive at infallible certitude regarding some of these matters. However, for practical reasons, that doesn't happen every time we have a decision to make in life. And so there we can't, and when it hasn't happened, we can still have doubt about what's the moral status of this. When we have that doubt, This is a subcase of the problem of evil. And so for that, see my talk on the problem of evil. You can go to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Jimmy Akin, type in problem of evil, and you'll get a bunch of stuff where I've talked about it. But to give the basic answer, God would not, as the Catechism says, God would not allow an evil without using that evil to bring about an equal or greater good. Therefore, if we have doubt about the moral status of some action that we've committed or might commit, then God will use that doubt to bring about an equal or greater good. Otherwise, he wouldn't allow the doubt. And we can then speculate on what good he might be bringing out of it. And one proposal that some have made is what's known as a soul-building theodicy. A theodicy is an explanation for why an evil exists. And some have proposed it builds up our souls if we're forced to confront doubt and deal with it and make moral progress and learn moral integrity and build moral muscle. That doubt actually helps us in that regard. But there are other possible explanations too, so it's an open question. But the basic answer is God wouldn't allow it if he wasn't going to bring about a greater good.
Thanks, Dennis. I'm going to keep moving quickly because we're getting near the end. And Burke's 6705 asked this, what if a person had no faith all its life, just refused to believe, and then gets dementia or Alzheimer's? Is there still hope for them to get to heaven?
Yes, because we never know the state of another's heart in this life. They may, even despite their overt unbelief, they may, before the onset of dementia, have responded to God's grace on some deep level that didn't result in conscious faith, but they may have lacked conscious faith through no fault of their own, you know, just because the way they were raised, or they never saw a convincing case for faith. And then they did respond according to the level of light and grace they had. And so they were already in a state of grace before the dementia set in, and then they would have remained in one. On the other hand, suppose that didn't happen. Suppose they were not in a state of grace when the dementia set in. Well, God can still reach their hearts in a way that's invisible to us after dementia. And he could even reach them in the last moments of life. There's a phenomenon where people with dementia sometimes wake up, known as terminal lucidity. It's in episode 312 of Mysterious World, which is mysterious.fm/312 if you want to learn more about it. But it's possible that even as the person was dying, God could have enlightened them and helped them achieve a state of grace as they were dying. So there are multiple ways that this person could still be saved and we can still have hope for them.
Thanks. One more I think I can get. Paul asked this, can you please contrast the passage from Luke 1:28, where the angel Gabriel addresses Mary with the greeting, Hail, full of grace, with the passage from Acts 6:8, also authored by Luke, where Stephen is described as full of grace. Thanks. Permanent deacon here.
Yeah, so Acts 6:8 that describes Stephen, it literally does in Greek say Stephen was full of grace. That's the literal meaning of the text that's used. In Acts 1:28, it does not literally say full of grace in Greek. You'll hear people trying to justify it as a literal interpretation, and the truth is, it's not. If I were translating Luke 1:28 literally, it would be something like lady who has been favored, or lady who has been graced. Full of grace is a traditional but poetic or non-literal translation of what the Greek says in this verse. It was used in St. Jerome's Latin Vulgate, and so it's become traditional, but it is not a literal rendering of what the Greek says. In Luke 1:28, unlike Acts 6:8, it's not full of grace, it's lady who has been graced.
Paul, thank you very much for the question. Thanks for everybody who got their questions to Jimmy or to us one way or another.
30 questions in 2 hours.
Are you kidding me? Really? That was 30?
That was question 30.
Holy smokes. I don't know if it's a new record, but it's a worthy achievement one way or the other. Jimmy Akin has been our guest, and you can find Jimmy has already given out his YouTube. Akin is A-I-N.
A-K-I-N.
Sorry, I got it backwards. You can find him on YouTube. You can find him at mysterious.fm or anywhere where you get podcasts for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, I enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun going through all those questions.
Me too.
All right, well, that'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.